Today is Wednesday, October 7, 2020. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
Morning, Tom. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Great. Kurt, may we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Certainly.
Thank you. We ended up finishing up part 5. You were talking about the high water of 1983, and that this was under the Incident Command Structure, the ICS system. And I wonder if you could pick that thread up.
I think what I mentioned was a thought that we probably used in the Incident Command System during that 2-3 day incident of evacuating some 164 people. My recollection is the early 80s Incident Command System was just being implemented in the National Park Service. At least that's my recollection.
Okay.
And we had, we were fortunate to have a fellow by the name of Paul Anderson, who I believe was the Inner Canyon Backcountry Sub-District Ranger at the time. And he was one of the leaders in the implementation of ICS in the Park Service, as far as I recall.
Okay.
So we had quite a few training sessions on it, and you know, searches and rescues were not uncommon at all. Hikers would be hiking across the Tonto Plateau and, however it happened, become disoriented or run out of water or take a bad fall. So in addition to river rescues, and most of the river rescues were one flight in, one flight out, or maybe a couple flights. But the searches could go on for days. Weeks, and I'm certain that we were using ICS. Can't remember the fellow's name, but he went missing, supposedly hiking to Phantom Ranch, and we conducted what I recall is a 10-day search for him, and never found him. As far as I know, he's never been found. But utilized Incident Command System, and big difference with Incident Command System for most people that are in a military or quasi-military structure is you can end up working for somebody that, you know, you might be in logistics or in planning or operations or finance, and you can end up working for somebody that you usually didn't work for, or was somebody that worked for you. Just depended on how the experience they were, and when they showed up to the incident. But over the years, ICS is now utilized in almost all emergency operations in the Park Service, and I think throughout the United States.
So,
it started in California.
Is that a good thing that, you know, basically it sounds like the structure was built on skills. It didn't matter what your job title was.
Exactly.
Okay.
If you were good in operations, you ended up working in the operations section. But planning is a critical activity in any operation. And we've had a lot of wildland fires out here in California and all along the western United States this year. And, you know, the firefighters out on the line are the ones that show up on TV. I'm trying to think of another incident that just occurred recently that was a fire. Well, the COVID-19.
Okay.
And just the logistics behind locating, acquiring, receiving, and distributing PPEs in the various states and at the national level. And, you know, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and their abilities to respond to hurricanes. And, you know, everybody sees the folks that are out doing the work.
Right.
That's what the media covers. But those people all have to be fed. They all have to be sheltered. They all have to be tracked. And that's done in the planning section. And then they have to be able to, they get an assignment, but they need to be transported at certain times to certain places. And just the whole logistical layout of making sure that they have the tools and the equipment they need, and that it is at the correct staging area at the correct time. The helicopter shows up and flies over your house at 7 o'clock in the morning. Well, people have been working all night to make sure that those helicopters are ready to go because they were used all day yesterday.
Hmm.
Same with the air tankers. So logistics, planning, and finance are just as critical in an ICS structure in an incident as the operations. I think it'd be nice if sometimes the news media would back away from standing in front of burned down buildings and saying, "Ooh, the fires are raging," and just do a report on the logistics required to house and feed these people. Once they get released from an incident, they're tracked until they get back to home base.
Okay. How did that differ from what was happening in the 1970s? Because, you know, people were getting lost or hurt in the 70s and 60s and 50s. What did the ICS bring in as a tool that you guys, you know, clearly embraced?
I think it was future planning.
Okay.
Two planning meetings in every 24-hour period. And at night, you're taking the information received from the searchers or the information received from overflight to the fire perimeter. And, let's simplify. Let's just stay with searching. You know, you have broken up your search area into probabilities of area and probabilities of detection. And prior to this, you would search an area, and then if you didn't find somebody, well, let's try another area. But you may not have searched that area well enough, and so your probability of detection was never really considered.
Huh.
And the probability that the hiker would be in an area was just sort of determined by, well, he was supposed to hike up over here, and then he was supposed to go over there. But he took the time in the planning meetings to take the information that you'd received by properly debriefing the search teams, either over the radio or when they came into base camp. And their level of expertise. I mean, if you have 20 volunteers that have never searched, their probability of detection in a certain area is much lower than an experienced search crew.
Okay.
And that's all factored into what the probability of detection in that search area would be. And if it's a high probability of area and a low probability of detection, then you need to put more personnel into the area and search it again. And, you know, very simplified, if you search from north to south and the next search team is going to search from east to west. Of course, terrain affects that considerably.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Prior to ICS, I would think it would be safe to say a lot of it was based on gut feelings of the searchers. And they became tired because you hadn't ordered, you hadn't planned ahead, and you didn't have enough staff, personnel, to adequately cover every place. So you started breaking up your teams. There's a whole lot of things that ICS brought up. Containment, hasty search, probability of area, probability of detection, all those things that caused us to take some of the more experienced folks that were out in the field and pull them in to be on the overhead team so that they would have a larger perspective of the entire situation.
Nice.
That's what I saw as a change.
And did you see that produce results? I mean, it's clearly hard to quantify when there's someone missing and it takes 10 days to find them, or 5 days, or a day, with and without the ICS. Did you get a sense that it was really not only working to help find people, but was at the very least covering the needs of the people on the search, and how that at least was arranged? Because that sounds like a big part of this.
I think it increased the safety of the people on the incident.
Nice.
Even to the extent where, I don't know what decade it was, but one of the frequent causes of fatalities for firefighters was they would be released after fighting fires for 10 days or 12-hour shifts, and frequently in your initial response you work long shifts.
Mm-hmm.
24 hours is not uncommon still. And, they're anxious to get home, and they just work their third 12-hour shift, and they've been sleeping in base camps that are inundated with smoke, and they're tired, they're exhausted, and they get released. They used to get released, and they'd end up falling asleep at the wheel. So now it's not uncommon at all. Even though you're going to be released, you are held in camp for 8 hours until you can get some rest.
Nice.
And tracking the personnel to make sure they get home on time is now commonplace. I just think it improved the communications and the planning in emergency operations, especially emergency operations of long duration, significantly.
Nice.
And so now, nationally, regionally, there are incident management teams different levels of expertise, and the larger a search gets, one time I just had a thought, a Joshua Tree in the 2000s, we had 8 different fires in 5 different days, and it was during the fire season, and we had a limited number of personnel that could respond, because, I'm talking county and state and BLM and Park Service, and everybody in the park was exhausted. And then we had another fire start up, and it was a relatively small fire. It should have been fought with a Type 3 Incident Command Team. Well, there weren't any Type 2 Incident Command Teams available. And we were so tired that I requested a Type 3. Excuse me, 3 in the Type 2. And they came in, and I basically apologized to them and said, this is a lot smaller than what you usually handle, but my personnel are exhausted, and they are not functioning in a safe manner. So the ability to draw in additional resources through the incident command system is of great value.
Nice.
Especially when you consider fire seasons like this in the West.
Yeah, it's just been brutal. Okay. Nice. And so that was used in 83 for, not, as you were mentioning, not just the river, but for search and rescue and fire.
Yeah, it was probably even earlier than 83.
Okay.
but yeah, it was well utilized by December of 84 when I left the canyon.
What else do you remember about 1983?
Well, let's see. There's, I mentioned that Georgie gave my son a baby blanket. So my son was born in September 12th, 1983.
What's his name?
His name is Richard Damien Sauer. But his name when he was born became Cubby.
Who was he named after?
He was named after my father, Richard. Richard Leroy Sauer. And he was named after the character in the book Damien by Herman Hesse. That's his middle name. And he didn't like Richard, so he became known as Damien, but he's always been known as Cubby to me.
Nice.
And, actually, I know that you're interviewing another person by the name of Kim Johnson, who was a boat person. Became very good friends, and she would go out for her daily runs and stop by the house because my wife at the time, Connor, always had a full cookie jar, so she planned her runs to end up at our house, grab a couple cookies. And one day she walked in and said to Connor, so how's it doing? And I said, it's doing fine. She said, you know, we got to quit calling it. Because it's going to get a complex. Well, we had a, what do you call that? Not a lottery, but you can raise money by, I don't know what it's called, basketball pool or something. Anyway, you could choose the day of the month, the morning or the afternoon, male or female.
Okay.
Well, she said, you know, you guys like bears, so it's a baby bear, so we could call it Cubby, or we could call it Cub. And we decided that we would call the baby Cubby, because that if we called it Cub, that would indicate that it was male, and Cubby would be either male or female.
Oh, that's neat.
So anyway, I think we ended up raising about $200 or something.
Wow.
And the name just stuck. And Brad Lundquist, he won the pool, took his half, went out and bought Cubby a football. So that's Richard Damien Sauer became Cubby, all because of Kimmy Johnson stopping by for some cookies in the cookie jar.
Nice.
Anyway, that was a highlight. We went into labor, and we drove the 60 miles down to Flagstaff to get to the hospital. In the end, she wasn't fully dilated. We got a motel room and spent the night in a, Motel 6, some sort of motel like that. Turned on the TV, and it was the first time I'd ever seen MTV.
Huh.
I thought, this is the strangest thing. But I ended up watching MTV for about 4 hours while my wife was in labor. And we eventually went back to the hospital. And 26-hour delivery.
Whoa.
Finally had to, he was 10 pounds, 10 ounces.
Whoa.
Had to be a C-section. And Mom wasn't there. She was in recovery, and I was in the nursery with him. He was 10 pounds, 10 ounces. The nurses had fastened some of that cloth you use underneath a cast into a beanie, a stocking cap, to help him keep his body warm. And he was on oxygen and covered in a little plastic cover. The oxygen. So I was the first one to see him. In fact, I was in the operating room when he was delivered. And first one to be with him in the nursery. And that was a life-changing event.
Nice.
So I quit climbing after that and quit taking so many risks. And at the time, we had a Volkswagen bus and a Volkswagen Karmann Ghia, and couldn't transport Honor and him home in the Karmann Ghia, and the Volkswagen bus at that point wasn't dependable enough to drive back and forth, so I needed to ride home, and called up Superintendent Dick Marks, said, hey, would you mind picking us up at the hospital? And he said, no, I'll be right down. So he and Haz, his wife, showed up in their Mercedes-Benz. Cubby was transported back to south rim of the Grand Canyon in the Mercedes-Benz.
Nice.
Quite the event there on September 12th and 13th.
Hmm. Nice.
And I think we took him hiking the first time. Of course, he was in a backpack, but baby carrier, when he was 4 weeks old.
Where'd you go?
We went down the Bright Angel Trail.
Nice.
A couple miles.
Nice.
Turned around and came back up. And yeah, so that started his exposure to parks, and eventually became a seasonal firefighter in high school, and at his senior year at Olympic National Park, and got on was firefighter, the Bureau of Land Management at the Mojave National Preserve. Did that for several years. Became a seasonal park ranger at Lake Mead National Recreation Area. Eventually told me that Park Service wasn't the same as when you were there, Dad. And got a job with the Hot Shots out of Prescott, Arizona. I think it's Red Mountain Hot Shots. Worked for them for a year and decided that he didn't want to be away from his wife and kid at the time. So he quit the Hot Shots and joined the Army. And 2 years after he quit the Hot Shot crew, they were burned over.
Right.
In a fire. I think, I don't know the numbers, 19 out of 20 of them were killed.
That's the Yarnell fire.
Yeah. So, he's had a storied past, mostly around the outdoors.
Nice.
And now he's creating a storied past and present with the Army.
Nice.
Stationed at Fort Bragg, he's in special operations and was deployed twice to the Middle East and will deploy again in May.
Nice. Well, it sounds like you're very proud of him. For a good reason.
Yeah. He's my best friend.
Nice.
Which I find interesting because my dad and I were best friends. So.
Well, it's a testament to your father on mm-hmm. on how to have a relationship with a child.
Kids.
So with a kid, yeah. Well, with another man now who's grown up. So yeah.
Yeah, so that was September of 83.
So at that point, you're still working the river unit manager, and were you thinking about transferring out of Grand Canyon by then, or were you pretty comfortable there at Grand Canyon with what you were doing?
Well, I was pretty comfortable. It was challenging. But yeah, I started thinking about transferring. We'd been there 5 years. And the way you progress in the Park Service is you transfer. It's very seldom that you're in a, you know, like a sub-district ranger position and you become the district ranger and then you become the chief ranger of the park. It just doesn't happen very often at all.
Okay.
So I was looking to transfer. And
can you stop here for just a minute and talk about that practice? Because one of the things that I wonder about is the loss of institutional memory. If you want to climb a ladder, which is certainly understandable, that requires moving. And when you arrive, having climbed the next rung of the ladder, you don't necessarily know very much about the place you're arriving at. I could be wrong on that, just as an outsider looking in.
Well, that's one aspect of it. I think that people... first of all, I think that... it's a change in all of federal service. I mean, I don't know about all of federal service, but certainly the Forest Service and Park Service in the 50s and the 60s, the men of the head of the family have the job, and the wife follows the man. She might have a job or she might not. Well, that's all changing in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And so now you have men and women in the Park Service. But they have, they could be single. They're usually married by a certain age. And you have a spouse that has a profession of their own. And so, over the years, the rate of transfer has changed. And some people that are probably quite qualified to be the district ranger or the chief ranger that are working at another park choose not to apply because it means that their spouse would have to uproot their career. Or end their career.
Yeah.
And another consideration now is the quality of the school districts that you're transferring to, and the economic viability of having a comfortable life. And the fact that required occupancy for park rangers has become less and less. So, and the fact that in the 50s, your rent in the 60s, your rent when you were required occupancy and you had to live in a house inside the park, the rent was very inexpensive compared to the outside, because most of the outside was tourist towns,
right,
and retirement communities. So, but then someplace in the 60s and 70s, they decided that rents were too low and the Park Service was not recuperating enough revenue to maintain the houses. So they did comparability studies of the surrounding community. Well, if you're living in an old log cabin, well, stone cabin in the Tetons,
mm-hmm.
and your community that's comparable is Jackson Hole,
right,
your rents become exorbitant. And so people decide, well, we can't afford to live there. And it's not unique to the Park Service. I have a friend that works for the California Highway Patrol. And he graduated top of class of his academy. And he was given his choice. You can go anywhere you'd like, and we'd like you to go to San Francisco, or we'd like you to go to L.A. Well, there's a young family, and they took a look at cost of living in San Francisco and decided that they would take a rural area out in the desert. So, you know, it's not unique to the Park Service, and certainly the Forest Service has the same situation. And, you know, so there's all those factors that have changed. And, yeah, to some degree it's going to affect the application pool. But there are, most of the time, the people that are hired can handle the job, and they learn very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they bring exposure in various interactions with the communities, various interactions with political decisions that needed to be made. And they have the Park Service policies to follow. So,
right.
And there's almost always there's the old timers that have been there for a while, and they've just decided that I like it here, my spouse likes it here, we like the school district, and we're staying.
Right.
And the new guy shows up, the new gal shows up, and if they are wise enough, they will spend a considerable amount of time talking to the old-timers, not just in the ranger ranks, but in the maintenance ranks,
mm-hmm.
and nowadays in the resource management ranks, to see what's going on.
Right, and that helps with the institutional memory.
Yeah.
And one thing, you know, the average, in quotes, American, you know, looks to buy a house as an investment over the span of one's career, and with required occupancy, that doesn't always equate to being able to do that, and so it
hardly ever equates.
Yeah, it sets you up for a fall when you do retire, because you don't have that place to hang your hat, and if you haven't managed your money well, you don't have $200,000 or $300,000 to plunk down and buy a house.
Right.
Where you want to retire. So it yeah, would, it's a trap there in a way. It's a nice trap because, you know, it's made of gold, but it's a trap.
Well, and it used to be that you had the parks to yourself in the winter.
Uh-huh.
And you don't have the parks to yourself anymore.
Hmm.
So I just spoke with a friend of mine who went up to the Tetons 2 weeks ago, and they were in Jackson Hole, and went into the park, and even at 8 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, the place was packed.
Wow.
And this is coming from a fellow, well, it's coming from Larry Vance Life, my original mentor.
Huh.
And, you know, he said, Kurt, I don't know what happened. People are supposed to come and see the parks. The population of this country has grown so much in the last 60 years. And the ability to travel, and, you know, even with COVID-19 this year, they're still going to the parks, which is what they're there for. But for the old-timers, it's kind of like, what happened? So, population.
Yeah, thinking about the 150th anniversary of John Wesley Powell's trip through Grand Canyon was last year, and the population of the country has increased by a factor of 10.
Mm.
We haven't built another Grand Canyon or another Tetons or another glacier or a Joshua Tree or anything else. But the population's just really going up. And that puts a whole new set of pressures on the agency and the staff there. Which, you know, looking back now 30 years ago, back to 1984, 83, was a whole, you know, a population of 9, not a population of 10. Or 8.
Right.
With that growth curve. Hmm.
And it's just going to continue.
So yeah. Yeah.
There will come a time that there will be use limits on parks.
Well, this is a good, time to sort of walk down that avenue a little bit, because we're talking about this. How do you see that? How do you see that working?
Not very well.
Okay.
I think it would be a shame. And again, the economics and the politics is going to be what shapes it, rather than the policy of conserving the natural and historic objects and the wildlife therein. There'll be a tremendous, tremendous pushback, and the science will be belittled, and the animal and vegetation populations will continue to be impacted and dwindled, because people will continue to come and carrying capacities will be established at a too high of a level. But ultimately, you're going to have to get reservations. You know, you already have to get reservations for the campgrounds, because there's a finite number of camping spots.
Right.
Eventually, the Park Service will come up with a finite number of visitors that, and they'll say it reaches the carrying capacity. And in those areas that are visited by most of the visitors, that carrying capacity will be entirely too high, and the place will be impacted, I would say. You know, if you look at some of the areas, the most recent park I was at was Joshua Tree. If you look at some of the areas, you know, hike up to Barker Dam, we put in a new parking lot, let's see, 2010, 2007, at Barker Dam that was twice as large as what was there. And now it is during the visitation season, it is totally overflowing. The trail is probably twice as wide as it was when I arrived there in 2002-03. And there's just no quiet. In fact, it used to be a place where you could just get up there about 8, 9 o'clock in the morning and watch some bighorn, desert bighorn.
Hmm.
And now, if you want to see the desert bighorn, you need to get up there about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning before the people show up. Because they just leave. They come down for water at Barker Dam and then they leave. So anyway, how is carrying capacity going to be established? Park Service has been talking about carrying capacity for over 40 years.
Okay.
And every time you talk about carrying capacity and you start factoring in the natural processes and the ecosystem, you run into a buzzsaw because economics is what the surrounding communities are interested in.
Yep.
You know, Yellowstone's a prime example. Fortunately for Joshua Tree, the surrounding community of Joshua Tree, 10,000 people, most of them that use the park highly value it, and they're interested in protecting the park. But the interesting phenomenon for me, most of the people that live around national parks, I won't say most, many of the people that live around national parks, don't care for them and don't utilize them. And the visitors come from various distances and think it's wonderful. Most of the people that live around forests actually utilize the forests. Of course, they have multiple recreation in those areas. So you can go snowmobiling, you can go hunting, and you can go hiking, and you can go camping, and the locals like the Forest Service, and the locals, most of the time, I would say, don't particularly care for the Park Service and its policies.
Hmm.
Too restrictive.
Yeah, that's a non-impairment mandate in the Organic Act, but that's what keeps the parks.
Well, I've often thought about what the parks look like now compared to what they looked like in the 50s and 40s.
Good point.
And most of the parks in the areas that the people don't visit look pretty much the same. It's the areas that people visit, the areas where the concessioners have been brought in. The golf courses and the ski areas are pretty well dwindling out inside the parks. But the areas that the people visit, Old Faithful. Old Faithful in the 70s, we went there and there were probably another 30 people watching Old Faithful in the fall. And the Old Faithful Inn had, 30 people in it that weren't staying there. And I just went up to Old Faithful last year on a multi-park trip. And we actually went into the park at 5 o'clock in the morning and left by 10:30.
Whoa.
Because there were just too many people. I mean, you couldn't pull into the parking lots at the geyser basins. Old Faithful Lodge parking area, which is huge, was full.
This is on a fall day?
This one was on, that would have been late June and July.
Okay, so kind of peak summer.
Yeah. The fall that I referenced was we traveled up to the Tetons for a Ranger rendezvous in the fall, and there just weren't that many people.
Right.
But during the summers at Old Faithful, and you know, there are wooden bleachers, and well, actually, I think they're metal bleachers constructed. And I counted over 2,000 people, most of whom were talking loudly on their phones, swearing, drinking, and Old Faithful went off, and they're like, well, that's not very tall. So what they see is nothing compared to what we saw even in the 60s and 70s, for me in the 70s. And just the whole venue. Fortunately, you can if you go in at 5 o'clock on July 3rd, you can stop alongside the road and watch a baby bison that's just been born learn to walk.
Yeah.
And there were no bear jams or anything. That's the way it used to be, and that's what Larry was talking about at the Tetons 2 weeks ago.
It's interesting because it seems the push continues to increase use in the off season, and I'm just wondering if that's the answer or not. I mean, you have to draw the line somewhere and say, all right, well, we're going to try to keep that spectrum of visitor experiences alive by limiting those numbers in the off season. But then again, you have economic pressures and political pressures to, as you mentioned.
Right. If the resource managers were able to implement plans that they could implement, there wouldn't be as many people. You know, wolves in Yellowstone is a great example. It took decades. And there's YouTube videos on the changes to the ecosystem from wolves.
Right.
You know, just one simple act. And it's changed how the elk and the moose behave. It's changed the river flows. It's changed the vegetation of the forests and the meadows. That's what Park Service Organic Act was about, for conserving the natural and historic objects and the wildlife therein.
Right.
Then you have to provide for their enjoyment, unimpaired enjoyment of future generations. Well, the future generations are here, and they want in.
Right.
So, you know, carrying capacity is going to continue to be a discussion long into the future. But I have hope, as I said, most of the areas where the people don't visit are still the way they were. Now, obviously, if you exterminate all the wolves and all the mountain lions, the Grand Canyon, you're going to change that, but they come back, and or they get reintroduced. So long term, if you want to go see a national park that existed as a vignette of America, you have to take the time to go to places of the parks that people don't go.
Right.
And more people will figure that out, and more people will have the money to do that and the time. And then those places are going to be impacted.
Right.
So, it's a balancing act. Come back to my chief rangers. I don't know if I mentioned this to you on the record, but my chief ranger in Grand Canyon, his name escapes me right now, had a picture of the, I think it was Tonga National Forest. Anyway, it was a national, it was a forest landscape clear cutting. And the title was Mitigation is a Code Word for You Have Already Lost.
Mm.
So if you have to mitigate,
yep.
You're already lost.
Yep. Yeah.
Pretty uplifting discussion, huh?
I think it's an important discussion, actually, because this is a serious problem that if we want to have a concept of unimpaired natural resources for the enjoyment of future generations, in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. I mean, non-impairment comes first.
Well, I would think so, but we'll see what happens. We're going to have to pause for a minute. Someone's knocking on my front door.
Okay.
Hold on a second. Okay, I'm back. You there?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's a difficult discussion about, you know, looking at the careers of Park Service people that many of them are saying what you're saying is, you know, I got into the job 30, 40 years ago. Today, things are different.
Yep.
And
which takes me back to, you know, we've discussed George Wagner, Rick, and or Dick, and Bert McLaren, and the second and third generation people that raised me. They were thinking the same thing.
Interesting.
This is so different. It's not the way it should be. But they had different values based on what they'd been brought up with. And
Kurt, yeah. I wonder if they had different values only if you took any one of them as a child and you landed them in the Tetons today, they'd look around and go, "Wow, this is great." And they wouldn't have that rearview mirror of history to look back on as you have now and as they had then.
Right.
I'm not sure it's a change of values. It's a vision of change over time. They saw, they were worried about, you saw, you're worried about. And none of us has a long enough yardstick of memory to understand and the changes over time.
And I suppose each generation can say, well, this is what I have now, and I need to take care of it, or I need to enjoy it.
Right.
I used to frequently. Sometimes I would think, you know, I've heard about reports from the early explorers of the West, along the national flyways and down in the swamps in Louisiana, where so many birds would migrate and would darken the sun.
Right.
That must have been a sight to behold.
Right.
But even now, you know, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe, at Joshua Tree, we were out up on a peak, up on some high land, looking at the land, and we're going to acquire some land for the Park Service through the Mojave Desert Land Trust. And one of the fellows that's with us is a birder. And we're all looking at the land, and he's looking up, and he said, "Kurt, look up. There are 100 white pelicans about 3,000 feet above us."
Whoa.
catching the wind currents, migrating to the Salton Sea.
Hmm.
And for us, 100 white pelicans was a phenomenal sight.
Right.
So thousands of brown pelicans in the Gulf used to be a phenomenal sight.
Yeah. Well, this has been an interesting turn of events on this discussion. maybe this is a good place to wrap this up, and we'll pick up part 7 with 1984.
Okay.
And we might go down this road again.
Philosophy of park management.
Yeah, I think it's important to explore, and I appreciate your taking the time to do it.
Okay, well, it certainly wasn't intended, but that's how I feel.
I'm glad we did it. I've got something else happening, so I'm gonna if it's okay with you, go ahead and wrap this one up.
Yeah, I got some windows to paint.
Okay.
To trim.
Good. Well, with that, this will conclude part 6, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer. Today's Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. My name's Tom Martin, and Kurt, thank you so very much.
You betcha. Thank you.